I'm delighted now to welcome Ruben Hirsch and Vera John Steiner. They are co-authors of the new book, Loving and Hating Mathematics, Challenging the Myths of Mathematical Life. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleased to meet you. Thanks for having me.
So in this book, which I have to say is completely readable for somebody who has not taken math in a very long time and who's not really followed mathematics as a field, you discuss the cultural and emotional and educational stories of mathematics, and you two, I guess, are very well positioned to write a book like this. You're a linguist and psychologist, Vera, and you, Ruben, are a mathematician. What led you to take on this project? Was there an event or some stories in particular?
Well, Vera said, let's think of something we can do together. So that's what we came up with. Originally, we were thinking mainly of the emotional side of mathematical life, but as we wrote about it, we were led also into the social and political aspects as well.
So what are some of the stereotypes about mathematicians and some of the myths about their work?
Well, one of them is that they are eccentric and removed from ordinary life and solitary. So part of what we explored, and I have sort of had the opportunity to watch from the outside, and I've noticed the intense friendships and the importance of communities among mathematicians. So the notion of solitary identity seemed a little oversimplified. Certainly mathematics requires periods of intense concentration, but it also requires, from what I could see, interaction, exchange of ideas, having fun together, sharing with each other what is new before it's in print. Many of the ways in which mathematicians share and support each other.
On the other hand, the eccentric piece is something that, although probably there's plenty of mathematicians who aren't eccentric, you certainly tell some stories of, for example, the mathematician who stops on the campus, has a conversation with a friend, and then says, which way was I going? And the guy points the direction. He says, oh, that means I've already eaten. I mean, that is a kind of sort of a typical, what one thinks of as an eccentric, absent-minded mathematician.
Well, that was Norbert Wiener, who was one of the great American mathematicians of the 20th century. And he was a legendary figure. People loved to tell stories about him, both because he was such an amusing eccentric as well as a great mathematician. He became better known for inventing cybernetics and for refusing to do military work and for resigning from the National Academy of Sciences as a matter of principle. He was a great man, and his eccentricities, in a way, made him more lovable, really.
But at the same time, we know a great number of mathematicians were not eccentric. Ruben and I talked about this briefly this morning, and he suggested that every stereotype has perhaps a kernel of truth in it, but it is a gross oversimplification, and that oversimplification can be harmful.
Now, what are some of the different kinds of thinking and creativity that are a part of mathematical thinking and innovation? It's not monolithic, as you beautifully point out in the book.
Well, I think that one of the intriguing things to me, because, as you know, I'm interested in different modalities of thinking, is that some mathematicians are very verbal. Ruben, for instance, is very verbal, logical in his thinking. Others are profoundly visual. And in some of the studies, it has been shown that some of the mathematicians who have gained recognition and early prizes and so on, we're very involved in puzzles and Legos, and so they are kinesthetic as well as visual. So in terms of modalities, we have a variety of modalities as entry points. But once a mathematician works, I think she or he relies on the interaction of a variety of modes of thinking.
Well, let me tell you two little stories. One about Andrew Wiles and the other about Paul Erdős. Andrew Wiles became famous for proving Fermat's last theorem. He first heard of it when he was 10 years old, reading Men of Mathematics by Eric Temple Bell. He was fascinated that such a simple problem that he could already understand was so difficult.
At 10 years old, he set out to prove it, and he did.
Well, he knew he couldn't prove it, but he was fascinated by the problem. Much later, when he was a professor at Princeton University, and it turned out that a certain seemingly different conjecture was related to Fermat's last theorem, he saw a way, and he worked secretly in his attic for 7 years. Finally, he had a friend with him to talk about it, and he only let the world know when he was ready to announce his result. That's one kind of mathematician. Paul Erdős, Hungarian, one of the most prolific mathematicians of all times, was so open and ready to work with other people that he was known for arriving at a friend's house and announcing, "My brain is open." They even said that when he took a train journey, he wrote a joint paper with the conductor. Two completely different personalities, both great mathematicians.
Talk about the aesthetic dimensions of mathematics. For many people, especially very accomplished mathematicians, beauty plays a very large role in their love of the field.
This is really very interesting because from the outside, it looks like a lot of formulas on the blackboard. And how can there be beauty in that? It just looks like one thing after another, and they look pretty much alike.
And sort of messy.
And messy, right. But there seems to be a real sense of aesthetics, not just in mathematics, but in many, many areas of creativity.
It's notoriously difficult to get across. Many mathematicians who feel intensely the beauty of the subject would despair at communicating it to outsiders. And yet, if you just talk about the aha experience, suddenly getting it, something that seems completely inexplicable, and suddenly you see, oh, this is what it's all about. Now it's simple. That's, I think, the most important element of mathematical beauty. Insight, simplification, understanding, coming sometimes just suddenly, but often only after a lot of hard work that somehow lays the groundwork for that discovery. Martin Gardner had a book called Aha, Insight, where he collected examples of this. I don't know if right now on the radio is the right time and place, but I certainly hope that on Friday and Saturday we'll have a chance to give at least one example of something beautiful in mathematics.
We're talking to Reuben Hirsch and Vera John Steiner about the book Loving and Hating Mathematics. So this is something that I wonder about, and there are questions that have to do with science as well as mathematics, but what is the nature of mathematical reality? So is it a human creation like art or dance, or is it a kind of discovery of pre-existing realities that have always been here since before human beings walked the earth and will be there long after we're gone? What are we talking about?
I can't believe that you don't know that you've asked exactly the question that I've been writing about for decades. I have a definite opinion about that, and I'll tell you, but I have to say that it's controversial, and many people get angry when I tell them the truth. The truth is that mathematics is something that people do. We invented it, we create it, we do it together. The reasons why sometimes it seems like it's something exterior, not part of the human race, have to do with some of its properties and its history. And certainly there is mathematical features, mathematical qualities in the external world. You ask a child, two, and the child raises two fingers. And that's really two fingers, no doubt about it. But the number two is something else the child doesn't understand. and can't until it's taught and learned. Abstractions are something we create and use and develop. That's what mathematics is.
So, for example, we discover a parabola, but we didn't invent the parabola. It was always there in the trajectory of things going up in the air and falling back down again.
Well, the truth is that the parabola is only an approximation. If you're studying actual motions of actual objects, whether shot from a gun or the motion of a planet, and you really want to get it right, parabola would only be the first approximation, and it would be much more complicated. And the more precise you want to be, the more complicated it gets. We simplify, look for something that we can grasp in an instant and pull it out and identify that. Even simpler than a parabola, circles. Everybody knows what a circle is. But if you talk about anything in reality that you think is a circle, you find, no, it's only approximately a circle. We think of it as a circle because that's the way we want to think of it.
For example, and this is a little bit outside of mathematics, but the periodic table. Once it was discovered that atoms had a certain number of protons and electrons and so on, the periodic table made sense. It had a reality, and even the boxes that were open, you didn't know what elements fit in there. Eventually they were found to fit in, and there's a sense, at least for me, that's kind of the archetypal example of this pre-existing thing that we discovered rather than invented.
Well, I have to admit, many people would see it the way you just said. That's called Platonism.
Yeah.
The idea that the mathematical forms are out there, as they say, and we manage to discover them. And I have to admit that my point of view is controversial, and I'm certainly prepared to argue it and discuss it.
And we will have a chance to this weekend. So why has mathematics been so male-dominated historically, and really even more than a lot of the other sciences and academic fields?
I think in part it has to do with this old dichotomy that women represent Earth and nature, and men represent abstraction and, in a way, the virtually invisible parts of what may lie above the clouds. And this notion that because women deal with the basic biological processes of reproduction, they have to be reality-oriented and rooted in reality.
And men don't?
And that men are excused from that. Yeah.
They have a role in the basic biological processes of reproduction.
That is true, but it doesn't take 9 months. And of course, for many of the centuries where women had minimal opportunities to participate in mathematics, there was no birth control and there were pregnancies after pregnancies. I think so part of it is that women got caught in these what was considered preordained roles, and that mathematics, being the most abstract of sciences, was most removed from that earthy, dirty, cleaning up after children and men reality that women's existence.
So to what extent were they not drawn to mathematics, and to what extent were they excluded from mathematics?
I think to a great extent they were excluded. Let me just tell you a quick personal story. I went to a gymnasium in Hungary, which was a girls' gymnasium. And
that means high school.
Right, though actually it was from ages 10 to 18. And our teachers were university professors who could no longer teach in universities because they were Jewish, and this was during the years when there were laws against, numerous Clausius laws against. The number of young women who became mathematicians in my class, a couple of them, one of them particularly world-renowned, was astonishing. Because the teachers whom we had wanted passionately to convey what they knew, facing possible extermination. So they gave their all to these young 10, 11, 12-year-olds who became excited and involved in this mathematics. This kind of experience for pre-adolescent girls is most uncommon.
Yeah.
So I don't see it as a biological limitation, which some people have traditionally seen it. I see it as a lack of opportunity to be exposed to a person who passionately loves the discipline.
In our book, we deal with this question repeatedly in several chapters. We tell life stories of three great female mathematicians: Sophie Germain, French at the time of the French Revolution; Sonia Kovalevskaya, Russian at the time of the Paris Commune revolt; Emmy Noether, a German Jew, a pacifist who lived through World War I. All of them created great mathematics. All of them had to overcome tremendous obstacles and discrimination, and they remember to this day. Nowadays, of course, there is a much more welcoming attitude toward women in the mathematical world, and there are many American women and others who are achieving a lot in mathematics.
We're talking to Reuben Hirsch and Vera John Steiner about their book, Loving and Hating Mathematics, Challenging the Myths of Mathematical Life. As you write, it's also been very much of a racist field, although perhaps not more than any other academic fields. But tell us about this man, Robert Lee Moore, whom you contrast to the African-American mathematician Clarence Stevens. Moore was, he was prejudiced against everybody except white guys, basically. Prejudiced against Jews, against women, and especially against black people, even while he had women and Jewish students, but not black students.
Well, I never met Robert Lee Moore. He was a little bit before my time. He was the reigning emperor of mathematics at the University of Texas in Austin for decades. He was finally, in his late 80s, pushed out with great effort. He became famous because of the amazing number of his students who became outstandingly successful in mathematical researchers. And his method is called the Moore method, and in some perhaps modified, less brutal form, it still goes on. The Moore method is exactly the mathematical counterpart of the method of teaching swimming, which everybody knows, sink or swim. You dump the person in. If they sink, too bad. If they swim, they may become great. Moore did that, and he was outstanding in the results he achieved, if you measure it that way. The fact that he wouldn't allow black people in his classes, that he would rant against women and Jews in his class, is not usually even mentioned very prominently when people write about him. But, of course, it's shameful that this went on in Austin for decades. Nowadays, there's an organization there that perpetuates his heritage of teaching, but which welcomes minorities and women. So we can say that Robert Lee Moore is a relic of the forgotten past.
Really, he had a very strong connection with the Confederacy, and his political and racial attitudes are very much the results of that background. It is important to mention that black mathematicians have been actively organizing and have been participating in attracting more men and women of color into mathematics. Perhaps the best known of them is Robert Moses, who was a very important civil rights leader. It requires, like in any pioneer endeavor, it requires young people to see how somebody from their own background can embrace a field and be happy in it and enthusiastic about it.
Well, you write about the African-American mathematician Clarence Stevens and his way of teaching, in contrast to Robert Lee Moore, was based on the notion that anybody can do math if you give them a chance and give them good teaching and draw them in. It wasn't sink or swim at all. It was much more nurturing. And one does wonder if this sort of cooperative and nurturing method on the one hand goes hand in hand with racial and other kinds of acceptance, whereas the competitive Moore method has, in a very essential way, a kind of intolerance built into it.
I think that you're right, and that is the sink and swim methods came out at a time when the society did not need as many mathematically literate and scientifically literate and literate people in general, because we had many factory jobs available. And so alienating a large part of the student body did not produce the same kind of societal cost.
Right, very interesting.
As it does now.
Yeah.
We can no longer do that. We argue that it doesn't mean that 100% of the student population needs to be highly developed in mathematics, but we certainly are very, very supportive of endeavors such as Moses's and Stevens's endeavors of welcoming and nurturing students. We think that if the teachers were not under the extraordinary pressure that they are under to compete, they could create more nurturing school environments,
which would then have higher achievement levels, even though they weren't quite as competitive.
Right.
I have had many experiences or meetings with people who were, let's say, rejected by mathematics, or thought they were, at a young age, and then, for some reason or other, developed a need or interest to learn mathematics as adults, and discovered that they could succeed and even have professional careers based on mathematics, even though they had been convinced when they were young that it was impossible. I can even mention the famous English mathematician Roger Penrose, one of the world leaders in relativity theory. He was left back as a child because he just couldn't do arithmetic the way he was supposed to. He had to figure it out and think about it, not just do it automatically. And so he was considered slow and had to be put back a year. The idea that it's do or die, now or never, once and for all, is such a terrible mistake. I want everybody who's listening to know you can do it if you want to.
Now, there is a lot of math anxiety, which the two of you put forth in your book, the proposition that that math anxiety is pretty much learned, and the teachers pass it on. You tell this wonderful, I mean, it's really not wonderful, horrible story about a little sixth grade girl who stopped being interested in math because her teachers wouldn't call on her because she was a girl, but her peers put her down for being too smart. So her teachers thought she was too dumb, her peers thought she was too smart, so she said, the heck with this, I'm leaving math. It has nothing to do with inherent ability or even interest.
That's a terrible story. Claire Fry, I hope you're listening.
So what is to be done, especially on the level of teaching the teachers to be excited about math? Elementary school teachers, they teach everything, and if they're anxious about math, they're sure to pass it on.
One of the most successful programs that I have heard of is one that was actually in Española with fourth and fifth grade math teachers who were given the opportunity to enroll in a summer program. And they were encouraged to accept that their own uncertainties when teaching math came from a long-standing attitude where female students were not encouraged and not nurtured, and to give them an opportunity when feeling more secure as teachers and as people to work together with parents and in a way relearn elementary level mathematics in this an attitude in that you are a person who knows her worth and you can take chances. The real problem with the way so much math is taught is that there is this attitude conveyed, you either get the right answer or forget it.
Right.
And there is something very appealing about the fact that in math there are right answers. Many people go into mathematics because of the appeal of that certainty. But it is not the correct pedagogy. The correct pedagogy requires guessing, accepting making mistakes, learning from the mistakes, feeling engaged at any level. And when teachers go into the math learning experience with some sense of self-confidence, they can convey it to the children too. And they can convey the truthfulness of their own experience. But the first time around, they had some difficulties.
And we won't have time to talk about it now, but in the book, which is highly recommended by me anyway, there are chapters, entire chapters on that engagement and absorption and even addiction that people get into when they come to this love of mathematics. I wanted to ask you before we go, aging is a problem for mathematicians because speed and memory diminish in the human being. Are there any advantages to age? In other words, do wisdom and maturity have a role in math as they do in, for example, you know, you think of the late compositions of Beethoven have a world of experience in them. Is there anything analogous to that in mathematics?
Oh, gosh. What a question to ask an 83-year-old mathematician. Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly some people fade out and lose it, like in any other field. On the other hand, some people seem to do ripen, as you say, and have more to offer. I once studied this in a kind of a way. I'm no sociologist, but I did send out a questionnaire to like 250 people and got over 60 answers about experiences getting old in mathematics. And there's all kinds of answers, from the best to the worst. But one answer that came along several times was that maybe young people have the strength to dig deep, but the older one can tell them where to dig. They know where is likely to be gold found.
Right. There's another thing that came out of that, and that's interesting, and that is that when people get older, they can broaden. They can work with collaborators outside of the discipline. They are not stuck in a particular position in their department where they're specialists just in one area. So it allows for an exploration and an innovation, if you wish, of how to use your mathematics that is a gift of aging.
Hans Freudenthal was a famous Dutch Jewish mathematician, great researcher, who in his later years founded an Institute of Mathematics Education at Leiden in Holland, which has been very influential both in Holland and the United States, and became a prolific writer on the history of mathematics, and became just a very broad scholar, philosopher, educator, much more than just a researcher as he got older.
Reuben Hirsch and Vera John Steiner are co-authors of the book Loving and Hating Mathematics, Challenging the Myths of Mathematical Life. Thank you both so much for being with us.
We enjoyed it. Thank you.